Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Hello, everyone. Global warming has so many ramifications, potential and already taking place, and so different for different parts of the world. It's hard to know where to set the priorities. The front page of the Times today has that stark story of the disappearance of ice in the Andes Mountains, which means no drinking water for lots of people in Bolivia as we speak. This is not some potential future. And as the Times puts it, that aspect of global warming is threatening the existence of nearly 100 million people in South America. The Pentagon, meanwhile, is preparing for warming scenarios as a national security issue. Maybe you heard that report on Morning Edition today, as nations become more likely to go to war over resources, including water. New York is its own story, and Mayor Bloomberg is in Copenhagen now for a meeting on urban areas and climate change as the global warming treaty negotiations continue toward this Friday's deadline. Cities consume two-thirds of energy, according to an International Energy Agency study last year. Let's talk about cities and climate change, and we'll also get into the politics of the developing nations led by African nations walking out today. Stephen Hammer, director of the Urban Energy Program at the Columbia University School of International and Public Affairs, is with us. He'll be at the same session with Mayor Bloomberg in Copenhagen tomorrow, and Shazeen Attari, postdoctoral fellow at the Center for Research on Environmental Decisions at Columbia's Earth Institute. Welcome to both of you. Good morning.
Brian, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Stephen, what's Mayor Bloomberg's role in Copenhagen, as you understand it, and what's yours?
Well, Mayor Bloomberg is widely considered to be a global leader on urban climate change issues through Plan YC and through the attention that he's paid to how New York City could change its emissions profile. He's really come to be seen as one of the mayors who is really breaking a new path, showing that cities can take action, showing that cities can really deliver while negotiators are simply talking about the issue.
Shazeen, I hear conflicting things, that cities are good for the climate because we use energy in a more efficient way than suburbs, or that the massive citification of China and other developing countries is a big contributor to warming and energy consumption. Is one or the other of those things more true?
I think personally both of them are true. I think in terms of China, I think it's also the increase of CO2 emissions from emerging economies that is sort of at the forefront of the Copenhagen negotiations at the moment. And that's also leads to the problem of actually getting a binding agreement from everyone on the table.
Explain that. Future emissions from emerging economies. Obviously, as more people live more of what we consider middle-class lifestyles, mm-hmm. they consume more energy. That means burning more fossil fuels based on the energy sources we need now, which contributes to more warming. Does it influence that people are forming cities more? They're literally developing city after city after city in China where there was none before.
Right.
I think so. Electrification is So actually people get living in these cities is both a good and a bad. So you have people that are moving out of rural areas that are moving towards a form of development which may resemble the U.S. U.S. lifestyles. And I think that is also something that we need to think about, is how do we get countries like India and China to leapfrog to greener technologies rather than putting coal-fired power plants online every week.
And Stephen Howe, I see you've given a talk on lessons that Shanghai in particular can learn from New York's energy plan. And can you give us some of those basics?
Well, you know, there's a lot that cities in China are hoping to learn from the West. They're also hoping to learn things not to do. Suburban sprawl is an area that when I'm spending time in China talking to mayors of different cities, there's a big focus on how to develop a compact city, how to develop transportation systems that look a lot like what New York has, like what London has, in a way to try and encourage people to stay out of cars. Now, you had mentioned the International Energy Agency study at the start of the session, and that raised all the information we really need to know about cities in China and how the energy path that they're on. If you look across the world, you tend to see that people in cities consume slightly less on a per capita basis than people who don't live in cities. In China, it's the complete opposite. They're consuming far more than people out in the countryside. That's obviously the wealth effect that's kicking in there, and that has huge implications, both for delivering sufficient energy to keep those cities going, but also for the rest of us.
Shazeen, how do you see the psychology of climate change right now? I see you did a paper on public perceptions of climate change, and if I'm reading this right, you found that people who are better at math understand climate change better than others, people who are more numerate. Do I have that right?
So they don't necessarily understand climate change better, but they have well-informed perceptions of energy consumption. So how much energy you use by different devices in your home. If you're more quantitative, you understand the differences between these different appliances much better.
You also say people's perceptions tend them toward reducing energy use altogether rather than more efficient energy use.
Right.
Can you explain the difference?
So Paul Gardner and Stern, they have a paper entitled The Short List, The Most Effective Behaviors Individuals Can Do to change their lifestyles in order to decrease CO2 emissions. And what they recommend in their paper is that we need to focus more on energy efficiency rather than curtailment. And what I found with my survey is that more people think that switching off the lights saves much more energy than actually switching to a more efficient light bulb, for example, which is actually opposite to what they recommend.
So what would be the public policy implications of understanding these perceptions?
So I think one big thing we need to do is try to figure out what my paper does is it sort of analyzes what are the major misperceptions in energy consumption. We somehow need to move forward and convey the results or try to correct misperceptions of energy consumption in order to hopefully change individual behavior, to try to get individuals to consume less energy per capita.
But Brian, you also have to take into account if you're talking about energy consumption or if you're talking about emissions, because in cities that have a large proportion of their power coming from hydropower, you know, clean, carbon-free hydropower, or for cities who have a large proportion of their power coming from nuclear power stations, again, carbon-free power source,
right,
you know, then it raises this interesting question, is how relevant is energy efficiency in that situation? Are we worried about it because people are spending more than they need to, because we're still wasting energy, or are we worried about it because we're emitting large amounts of carbon dioxide?
Our guests on WNYC, as we talk about climate change and cities and the Copenhagen Conference generally, Stephen Hammer, director of the Urban Energy Program at the Columbia University School of International and Public Affairs. He'll be at the session with Mayor Bloomberg in Copenhagen tomorrow. And Shazeen Attari, postdoctoral fellow at the Center for Research on Environmental Decisions at Columbia University's Earth Institute. Stephen, I've heard that at Copenhagen, one of the main tensions is rural interests versus urban interests. Do you see that as an issue in the climate treaty negotiations?
There was a meeting I was at a few weeks ago with a representative from the mayor's office in Delhi, and he made the point. He basically walked us all through the level of emissions coming out on a per capita basis from his city, and it's just so far lower than what you typically see in terms of emissions on a per capita basis from a Western city that it does raise this very interesting question. How much attention should they be focusing on reducing their emission levels compared to what we should be doing in the West, we who are responsible for, you know, historically, you know, most of the emissions that are currently in the atmosphere, and on an ongoing basis that we continue to dominate in terms of, you know, emission sources.
So that's kind of developing world cities versus developed world cities and how much they consume relatively, right?
Yes, and as Shazeem said, the real question is, can you try and pursue a strategy that addresses some of the current problems facing these cities in terms of jobs, in terms of housing, in terms of lack of water or sanitation infrastructure? Can you do that in ways that you leapfrog so that you begin to address, you know, achieve co-benefits in terms of addressing climate change at the same time you're addressing these very pressing day-in, day-out needs in those cities?
And let me get your reaction to today's news. The version I'm looking at at here is from the Mail and Guardian just a short time ago, and it says the UN climate summit was suspended today after a group of developing countries walked out of talks in an African-led protest. The walkout was prompted by concern that wealthier countries were leaning toward abandoning the Kyoto Protocol, the old protocol, which mandates binding emissions cuts for industrialized countries but excludes developing ones. Stephen, do you understand what that would be about?
Well, it's really just, I think it's a negotiation tactic. We're nearing the end. The heads of state are arriving, in a day or two, and they're the ones who really have to sign the final agreement. This is a stance that has been made clear by developing country nations, for the last several years. There was this accord that was leaked early last week, which said it might back away from some of the Kyoto-type commitments that were made back in 1996. But I don't know if this is going to put a stop to the entire negotiations. I think, this is from the start, this has been a challenging negotiations. You've got the global economic crisis at the same time. You've got the Copenhagen summit going on. It's going to take a lot of money to address this issue. Is it a cost of how much developed countries should bear themselves? Is it a matter of some type of economic transfer to developing countries, so that they can begin to make the necessary adaptation changes? Those are all very challenging issues, not one that one can easily resolve in a two-week period, even though folks have been talking about this for some time.
Shazeen, I know you're here mostly to talk about perception today and energy use, but do you have any take on whether this Copenhagen session this week is going to come to anything historic and anything that's actually going to stop global warming?
So I was actually at Copenhagen all last week, sort of trying to sit in and observe the plenary sessions. And there's a lot of, and as Stephen pointed out, there was a lot of growing frustration between the developing countries and the developed world in that who should bear the brunt of the burden. So I would like to be optimistic, but based on what I've heard so far, things are looking a little bit grim in terms of reaching a binding agreement.
Is there common ground possible, Shazeen, in your opinion, some kind of formula under which the developed countries cut back their energy use and the developing countries continue to develop as they need to do, but in a different way, a greener way, as you suggested, or with technology transfer from the West, those payments from the West?
So So as I said, I'm an optimist. So I think that tech transfer is a huge plays a really big role, as well as adaptation funds for countries that are going to be worst hit. But some of the major players, such as China, India, the U.S., think they probably have to come down and try to argue with the numbers and try to figure out where they will all sort of be happy at the end of the day, and that's a question of how and when.
And so, Stephen, the last word, as we look toward any possible agreement, I mean, the lifestyle implications for people in both the developed and developing worlds, if we can make that dichotomy, are so vast. The U.S. and some other Western nations are overdeveloped, you could say, and we need to decide how much to cut back on what might be our relatively wasteful lifestyles. China is still underdeveloped in so many other countries and need to decide how much to restrict their growth for climate purposes. For some countries like China, that means the explosive growth of the economy that's taken place now. For other countries, many of the African nations who walked out today, it just means trying to get people out of grinding rural poverty into some kind of more what we call middle-class lifestyle. Is that the right way to look at it, those kinds of conflicts?
I think you've characterized it really well. For me, it hit home when I saw the picture in the front page of the Times last week, where there was a picture of this Chinese man leaning on a big SUV at an auto show in China, and just with this dreamy look on his face, thinking about, boy, I really can't wait to buy this and have this, to show all my friends that I just bought this car. Again, I'm doing a lot of work in China lately, and we see the conflict you've described in every conversation we have with every mayor. They have this imperative 6-8% GDP growth that they must deliver, but at the same time, they realize there are huge pollution impacts of the growing energy consumption in their cities. The fact that it's primarily coal-based is, obviously key. So they're looking at ways that they can transition to a cleaner energy economy, but I don't think you're going to see the answers come easily. easily because they've got such vast coal reserves, because, again, the pressures to develop, the pressure for industrial growth are so dramatic that it's really going to be difficult for them to change consumer patterns as you begin to see, and it's, you know, millions and millions of people, all of whom now have spending money, all of whom want to have more creature comforts like they see in the West.
We'll continue to cover the Copenhagen conference all this week as they try to reach an agreement by Friday. Shazeen Atari and Stephen Hammer from Columbia University, thank you both very much.
Thank you, Brian. Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And coming up in a minute, we have Jane Brian Quinn, the personal finance columnist, and Joseph Sato from MySomeday.com as we continue our series on your uncommon economic New Year's resolutions. Stay with us.